We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Philip has just lost the respect of the Youth League football team he coaches. He was asked what New England should do in the draft, and his answer was objectively terrible. The Athletic just wrote a great article about this, but Philip doesn't have the Athletic or the respect of a boisterous group of 11-year-olds who once looked up to him. Learn from Philip's error, get the Athletic, and get the info you need to speak draft fluently.
Welcome to the Solid Verbal.
The Solid Verbal.
Come after me! I'm a man! I'm 40!
I've heard so many players say, well, I want to be happy. You want to be happy for a day? Eat a steak.
It's that woo woo!
And now, Dan and Ty.
Welcome back to the Solid Verbal, boys and girls. My name's Ty Hildebrandt. Joining me, as always, over there in the Chicago burbs, Dan Rubenstein. Sir, how are you?
I'm good. Just one burb. I'm pretty good. I'm down on sleep because that's how things operate when you are a parent of a four-week-old. But come on. I can't. Everybody does this that has a kid. You get a lot of love time in. It's great. A lot of cuddles and snuggles, Ty.
Oh, yeah. Solid Verbal at gmail.com.
Your snuggle and cuddle HQ.
Is our email address. Verballers.com is where you can go to find all the goods on the Patreon. Don't forget to follow along using your podcasting app of choice, using your social media platform of choice. Dan and I are all over the place. Two episodes a week through this here off season. Probably as we get closer into what, July, Dan?
Mm-hmm.
Somewhere in that range, that's when we'll flip it back over and go three times a week to start to build excitement for the 2021 season.
Ooh.
As for now, though, happy spring. I believe our first episode of the new spring season here in 2021. Dan, you do anything exciting on the first day of spring?
No, but Solid Toddler went to the quote-unquote beach, which people call lake sand here. They call that the beach. And had a fantastic time, apparently. I was here in the podcast mind's tie.
Yeah.
But no, I haven't. It's been pretty nice. It's been spending time at some parks outside.
Does the little man like sand?
Loves.
Yeah.
Absolutely adores. You shake out his shoes after coming home, and it's robust, the amount of sand that's in there. Loves the beach, loves sandboxes. There's a bunch of trucks at a park near us in the sandbox, toy trucks, and can't get enough.
I feel like it goes either way with kids. I don't speak with any authority on this, but feels like they either love it or hate it.
No, he's the soil king. He likes all that stuff. Yeah. Muck and mud and sand and dirt and shovels and buckets, all of it. Count him in.
All right. Well, look, it's a pleasure to have everyone back here listening to the show. We've got a great and fun interview. Interview just for you, Dan, with our good friend Ari Wasserman. We had him on during our National Championship Live broadcast. But we invited him back in. Ari covers the national recruiting beat for the Athletic. So we're going to talk a little bit about that, but I think we're going to zoom out and talk some big picture stuff as well. I know he also wants to talk to you in excruciating detail about the pizza.
Agonizing detail about pizza. Here's the thing. If you listen to the show, you understand us at a certain point, and you know when things start to veer away from college football, you're either like, kind of in and want to hear what we have to say, or you're like, okay, that was enough college football, that was enough Ty, that was enough Dan. I can't imagine there's ever enough Ty, but I understand there being enough Dan, and you just go about your merry way. Thank you for the download, thank you for following, etc., etc. So yeah, he's also recently engaged.
Yeah,
we have, he's long been a digital food friend of mine, so I'm very excited for this show. What I want to do is I want to talk recruiting, but not like, hey, who's got a promising 2024 quarterback? I mean, that's fine. That's all good. But more like, what, I know you're fascinated with this Alabama class, and like, what Alabama and the Juggernauts, like Josie and the Pussycats, Alabama and the Juggernauts. We spend a lot of time, we spill a lot of audio ink during the season talking about like the playoff and is it good? Is it bad? Is it good to have no parity? Like, that's what I want to get into from a recruiting perspective, if that makes sense. Because it's national college football and recruiting. So I feel like that would be right in that center of that Ari Wasserman Venn diagram.
Why don't we do that? Again, you can find him at Ari Wasserman out on Twitter. We'll bring him on the show here momentarily. We've, again, got an episode coming up on Thursday. And as per usual, please go out to verballers.com, check out all the fun stuff that we are doing. Dan, NCAA tournament, we're recording this on a Monday, is well underway, going through the final few games of the second round. Your Oregon Ducks advancing, though only playing one game.
Yeah, I was going to say, advancing two rounds, playing one game. Tough to pull off. Ducks did it.
Ducks won handily earlier today against your Iowa Hawkeyes. Okay.
My Iowa Hawkeyes?
Sure. Without further ado, joining us now, we had him on, I believe, during the national championship, right?
Correct. Yes. The live stream, the extended live stream we did, we had him on.
Ari Wasserman, senior writer for The Athletic. He covers college football and recruiting, the national recruiting beat. Welcome back, Ari. How you doing?
You know, this is actually the dream come true, because I told you guys before the national title live stream that it was my dream to be on the Solid Verbal. And that doesn't count because this is the podcast. So this is the dream come true, right?
Wow.
This is,
why is that? If you don't mind me asking, I'm not fishing for compliments here, because I don't know what a Solid Verbal compliment looks like other than Ty's very handsome. But like, why is this a dream?
You have such unique personalities, and like, even like the way we were interacting before I came on the show, it's like, I wish you were recording yourself naming off all the quarterback names, because that's like gold.
Caden, Jaden, Tanner, Cade. Yeah, yeah. It's a heavy pioneer woman first name class of 2022 quarterback class.
And I think that everybody who listens to the podcast that I do with The Athletic is simultaneously amused but also frustrated with me. And I feel like if I were on this show all the time, I would feel more at home with people who think a little bit more like me. So, like, I think you guys have done a great job. I know firsthand how hard it is to create a podcast and get people to spend time listening to what you think, because like you, I don't know. I don't think that anything I think really matters. It's just I'm happen to be paid to do it. But
oh, we're same page. We know nothing we say matters. That's why we do things like how to tell your kids about an undefeated Iowa, because we just like to make each other giggle.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's funny.
That's essentially all it is.
And I enjoy the voicemails. I text you guys periodically. I think it's a great show. And if we're going to, I'm sure this is going to go off the rails here in a minute. So once we start getting into my brain, if we start talking about pizza and engagements and all the sorts of things that we might get into, then I'll start feeling at home, because I know less about engagement and than I do about football, but I know more about pizza than I do about football, I think. But nobody knows more about pizza than you do. So let's get riding. I'm ready to go.
This is true. So I did want to harken back to that last time we had you on. You were in Mexico.
I was.
I don't know if we ever made that abundantly clear to the captive audience that we had.
Yeah.
But you were... You were committed to the cause and piped in from Mexico during the national championship.
Well, like, the thing about it was that when I first started in my new national position at The Athletic, it coincided directly with the shutdown of football and sports because of Corona. So during that time, we had this vacation planned for a long time, and nobody was traveling to any of the games. So I thought this would be a good time for me to go. And then it turned out my girlfriend, now fiance, had booked a flight for the day after the national title game when I told her not to do that, because I was hoping to be home by then. But at that point, there was one game. I wasn't going to be traveling to it anyway. and I was watching it with Spanish commentary. So, you know, I wanted to be a part of the discussion and the discourse. So the idea of coming onto the show and talking about football after spending 5 days in a foreign country where college football doesn't really matter, it was just such a breath of fresh air. So it wasn't intentional. I don't think we're going to be going on any vacations during the national title game in the near future. But, you know, in a weird year, it just kind of worked out that way.
Was Tough Borland any faster in Spanish?
No.
Okay.
No.
That's the same word in English and Spanish.
Yeah, I don't. Yeah. No.
No. Por supuesto, no.
He wasn't. You know, I like go back and I've thought about some of the stuff that we were discussing before that game and then how it played out. And I must have looked like a major idiot because I didn't see that coming. But now that it happened, I should have seen it coming. So I didn't see Tough Borland covering the best player maybe in college football the past 5 years, one-on-one straight up. But I think that was more of a Alabama design than it was Ohio State's intention. So if you want to talk about recruiting, we can talk about how Alabama keeps doing this. I'd be more than happy to do that. But wow, yeah. What a game that was. I was hoping for a better experience, but by halftime, I was already checked out.
So, okay, let's get into recruiting then. I'm glad you gave me a perfect segue. Alabama, by all accounts, just signed the best class ever.
Mm-hmm.
It does, for anyone wondering, when is this train going to slow down? It does not appear as if that is set to occur. I don't know when that happens. We ask that question from time to time. When might that happen? We still have no answer for it. Like, are we at a point now with college football recruiting where other programs, to some extent, are demoralized by the fact that Bama is just so damn good at it?
You know, Alabama is its own monster, but I'm happy that we're on right now because I was working on my mailbag right before you called. And one of the questions was, what is the solution to college football's parity problem? And the answer to the question is in the math. And I went and did the math. Guess how many players in the top 100 nationally, so the most elite high school football prospects, went to one of six schools out of the top 100? And I think you can guess what the six schools are, but I'll tell you after.
I mean, if I had to guess the six schools, it's Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State, Georgia, A&M and Oregon? I don't remember which.
Oklahoma and LSU were the final two. But A&M and Oregon also did really well, but they had a lot of players in between 100 and 150, which is great.
Gotcha.
But the most elite players, do you want to guess the answer? Or do you 70, want me to just tell
75%.
I was going to say 66 players.
Okay, it's 58. And okay, it might be 59. So that's a little bit lower than what you thought. But 60% of the most elite players in the country going to six schools is directly the problem. And I think 13 or 14 of them went to Bama and 12 went to Ohio State. Those numbers are made up because 76% of stats are made up offhand. But like it's like in that general area. And the point of that is that I don't know if demoralize is the right word because I just think you can accept it. I think what's happening is that you accept the fact that Alabama can come into your territories and take your guys. And like that acceptance, I think, is the hardest thing because the biggest issue with the parity in college football is the disbursement of talent. And when it should be regional, it has now been national. And I think Alabama is single-handedly ruining the Big 12 and the Florida schools all at once. Like if you go look and see like what Alabama's done in Texas and what they've done in Florida, it's like the years of the Florida State, Florida, Miami dynasties that we all have grown up loving and watching are dead because the top players in the state of Florida are going to Alabama. And then of course, a few of them are going to Clemson and a few of them are going to Ohio State. And as this continues, you have certain territories that are usual breeding grounds or feeding grounds, not breeding. I don't know what I'm saying, but
yeah, it's okay.
You get it. And it's like the entire state of California is propped up to produce the entire Pac-12. So when you want to talk about why is the Pac-12 not as good as it used to be, it's because 12 of the top 25 players in California are going to Ohio State, Clemson, Georgia, Texas, and Oklahoma or wherever they're going. And they're not going to the schools that they used to go to. So, you know, Alabama has done it the best, but there are a few other teams, too, that are like right behind them. Like Ohio State's class is very similar to Alabama's. And Georgia has won the recruiting crown two out of the last four or five years after Alabama won it 8 years in a row. So, you know, I think that I don't know what the thing that has to happen to break that trend. Like what if Penn State, like imagine a world where Penn State kept all the best players in Pennsylvania, Washington, the Seattle area had three top 10 players nationally in Seattle. Only one's going to Washington. USC did what they...
And he's a legacy, yeah, too. Yeah.
You know, there's just like... And Arizona State kept the best players in Phoenix. And not only would the mega classes that are forming be weaker, but the classes that would prevent those from happening would be better. And then what would you have? More fun and more mystery when it came to who makes the college football playoff. So in this weird world of recruiting, the biggest problem, the most interesting thing is that these kids go to the same camps during normal years. They go to the opening. They go to the Under Armour camps. They text. They're on group threads. And like even this past year, you would think conventional wisdom was with this pandemic, kids might want to stay home. But what actually happened was they can't go anywhere. So geography didn't matter because it was all over Zoom. And then they just ended up going to the places that produced the most NFL picks. So all this stuff is just so hard to break down. I don't even know where to begin. Like, how do you solve the parity problem? You could just say keep kids home, but like, what's step one?
So, okay. So the parity problem, quote unquote problem, is it almost feels like it's reshuffling what college football's always been. It's always been a sport dominated by a select few. The few change over the years, but it's never been a sport where in any given year there are 17 legit national title threats. There's never been 17 teams built to beat anybody. And so I think what we have now is as the sports become more nationalized, as the internet has become such a force, social media and YouTube and everything like that, kids can watch Alabama's offense that live where's Najee Harris is from, like the Central Valley of California. Kids, you know, in Washington can watch Ohio State's offense every week. And so schools are getting richer monetarily, but now, and it's almost what we see in the NBA too, right? With the school, the teams on the coasts amassing all of the talent because you have a certain degree of freedom of decision-making that you didn't necessarily have in years past. So it's a problem in that you would like things to be more balanced, but has that ever been the case? Like USC is this dominant force in the early 2000s, and then the SEC jumps up because they're spending money. They have all these great coaches. I wonder what college football with parity looks like, and does it make it better that programs don't become recognizably elite, blue chip, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know. I don't think it's a solvable thing.
Well, the problem is that the playoff is supposed to encourage parity. And so when people think playoff, they think small NCAA tournament, which is known for what's going on right now. So when the same four teams are playing in the playoff every year, it diminishes the bowls and it takes things like the Rose Bowl and makes it less beautiful. And I think what's happening now is that you have a playoff system for 5 to 8 programs, and then everybody else is like, I'm going to go play in my meaningless bowl game. That doesn't matter like it used to. And, you know, right now, too, my biggest thing is if you were the head coach, the top rising head coach, and you get hired at UCLA or you get hired at Arizona State or one of these places that's in a fertile territory that has a lot of players, has a great campus, awesome atmosphere, cool stadium, cool uniforms, all the things that used to matter the most. Like, let's just use UCLA as an example. And I know Chip Kelly recruits his own players the way he wants to recruit them.
Yeah.
You know, but UCLA is located centrally to a lot of really good football players. Building a team to go from a top 20 program to a top 5 program into that cool club of those programs, what is step one? The answer has always been keep your players home. But as we all know, as much as we like to look back at college fondly and hope that the players that are going to our schools love our universities and want to bleed the colors of our team the way that we do, they want to go to the league. So what you have is a self-fulfilling prophecy. You have teams that are getting the best players out of high school, and then these teams are putting out more players into the NFL because these players are better to begin with. And then those players in the future think that they should go there because they're going to the NFL more frequently. So in a world where everybody has access to everyone and all that information is out there in a simple Google search, all you see right now are the NFL draft numbers from the past 10 years. That's the only thing you have to Google. And they correlate directly with the recruiting rankings. And it's how do you break through that? And like, building a program in college football has got to be the most frustrating, most impossible thing to do in the world. And like you said, it's always been the sport's always been dominated by a select few teams, but those teams have always cycled through. Like it's been 5-6 years here for this team, 5 or 6 years for that team. You know, Notre Dame had its time. Texas had its time. Oklahoma had its time. But it's like Alabama is doing this in the most cutthroat time for recruiting. Mm-hmm. And it's just like, is the answer just wait for Nick Saban to no longer coach? Or is there something that can proactively be done from a new coach at a place that isn't a traditional NFL factory to make that team a national title contender?
Ty, what's your UCLA answer?
My UCLA answer to what?
Yeah, yeah. So if you're UCLA and you're like, okay, how I hire, who is the upcomingest coach if Chip Kelly moves on? Like Matt Campbell, somebody that like genuinely is like, this guy is a young up-and-comer that's very promising, that has won big with lesser talent. Imagine what he could do with more talent. What is, I mean, UCLA is unique because it's in Los Angeles. It's in the second biggest city in the country. But like, what does any team that is not a traditional power do to build enough cachet, enough juice to say, oh, all of our local guys want to hang around here and we're going to pull in top kids from Arizona, Colorado, Texas, whatever?
Let me give you a perhaps crazy answer.
Because there are very few examples of that, like that kind of success at that kind of place.
This is actually going to be my question to Ari.
Yeah.
What if the answer is to develop a crazy ass marketing department? And I say that because we've got NIL on the horizon. We've got a new transfer rule on the horizon. When I interviewed Andy Staples a few weeks back, no one's really sure what the effect of that's going to be. But it is an outside variable that we haven't really had to account for much,
right?
You know, if at all, thus far.
But do you think selling probiotic tea on Instagram is enough to make up for
probably not
an NFL first round contract?
No, probably not. But it is an external factor that we should at least consider if you've got a program. I think the example Andy used was LSU, that is very proactive about trying to go out and build a marketing department for not only itself, but for its players to help make them more marketable to people who might want to spend some sponsorship dollars on them. That's an interesting proposition to make your program, you know, at least a little bit more appealing when you have to go up against a team like even a USC in the case of UCLA, some of the more traditional powers. I don't know how else you compete outside of some of these things that, you know, we didn't see coming and no one could really account for.
There's two ways of looking at NIL, and I don't think we'll really know exactly what that's going to be until it happens. But I think there's one way to look at it, which is once the door gets cracked open a little bit, you're going to bust through it and it's going to get out of hand pretty crazily. And the other way to look at it, which is the way I know Andy looks at it, is people are going to make money. They might make 50 grand. They might make 100 grand, which is a lot of money.
Sure.
You know, the most marketable players might make $100,000 through online sponsorships and Instagram posts and sponsored autograph sessions and all the things that they might be able to do now. But the thing that I think people are going to be privy to is that you can do that anywhere, and every college campus is passionate about the players that are on their team. And two, the number one goal for these people, these recruits, no matter where they're from or what they're rated, is to gain generational wealth through being a professional. Mm-hmm. And if players who are legitimately NFL prospects, and you know those players, you can see them in their high school tapes, you know, the top 100 players, you know, you are pretty good bets. It's a very short-sighted business decision to pick a school based on how many Instagram followers you can accumulate. Because mm-hmm. even if you take your eye off the ball for a minute and focus on your marketability as a student athlete, your real money is going to be in your draft stock and your second contract in your NFL and being developed into it. So, you know, I've had fantasies of, is Rutgers going to turn into a power now because they can hang a mm-hmm. banner of their best player in Manhattan? Is like Northwestern all of a sudden going to be marketable because right. they're in Chicago? Is UCLA being in Hollywood or being near Hollywood in the vicinity of Hollywood, or USC, going to be different because they're in Los Angeles? This is where everybody would want to live if they had the money to do it. Maybe not LA, but, you know, Manhattan Beach, Laguna Beach.
Sure. Yeah. Hollywood's kind of a dump.
Yeah. But yeah. But the answer to the question is, if I had a prospect who for a son that was being recruited, I would always continually emphasize the chance to get a great education, which, you know, matters, believe it or not, to some people. And two, put yourself in a position to wait three more years to get the generational wealth. And it's right. like you might have marketability at Northwestern. Maybe you might be more visibly nationally because of the city that they're in. But if you're a five-star quarterback and Alabama's recruiting you, Tuscaloosa and Chicago are very different places. But where are you going to go? Are you going to go to the place that might be able to get you a few $50,000 checks more? And again, that's a lot of money. I would take $50,000.
Same.
But when compared to the potential of the long-term view of your income possibilities, it's a drop in the bucket. So, you know, how you break through this, I think it's possible they might be more dispersed. Maybe it'll be 40 or 50 instead of 59 or 60. But I still don't see a world where Nick Saban and Dabo Sweeney and the big dogs of producing NFL talent all of a sudden lose the ability to get players because all of a sudden Instagram can become a monetary thing for these guys.
Yeah, and I think best case scenario for the side of parity would obviously be a couple kids a year, pick maybe the short-term hit, the short-term check over the longer-term marketability, profitability, draft stock, etc.
And you also can make the argument, too, that if you're really good and you go anywhere, then
it doesn't matter.
Really good.
Right.
Right. And that's the point I made about the self-fulfilling prophecy. So, like, I want to make sure I'm consistent on that.
Yeah. If Trevor Lawrence went to Indiana, he would be a top five pick.
Yeah.
It would be clear as day. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right.
But if he went to Indiana, maybe he wouldn't be. Maybe he'd be a first rounder, but maybe he, maybe Justin Fields would be the number one player in the draft right now because they're playing in the playoff and winning Heismans and doing those things. Like if Trevor Lawrence went to Indiana and got his head beat in for 4 years, I'm not saying he wouldn't be a generational talent, but optics is such a huge part of this whole thing too, guys. And like looking and looking good on January 1st in a playoff game is really part of the deal as well, especially at a quarterback position where leadership and wins and accountability and all those things come into play. So, you know, it's such a tough question. I get it asked all the time. What is NIL going to do to college football? It's like, in a are there going to be, because I did an anonymous coaching survey where recruiting assistant survey in December around signing day where I called 20 or 25 recruiting coordinators and just talked to them on the phone and asked them a bunch of questions. And I asked, do you see cheating in college football? And all of them said yes. Some said very little stuff, like too many calls or the bump-ins and all that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard people say that kids have been offered $250,000 to go. And it's like, are we going to be living in a world where every player in the top 35 of the 247 composite rankings can make $250,000 to go to school somewhere? And like, are the donors going to be able to do that? Like Les Wexner, who's a donor at Ohio State, who's like worth billions of dollars, is going to start backing up the Brinks truck every time Ohio State's recruiting a kid? Or are businessmen going to continue to be smart and rich by not wasting their money like that? So it's like, we don't really know the extent of where it's going to be. But if we land on the rational part of that, which is it's probably going to be pretty self-contained. Some kids might make more than others, but for the most part, they're just going to be making normal livable wages for adults. And the players who are less marketable might be making $5,000. And at that point, I don't know that it changes everything at all. But if we start talking about $250,000, then all of a sudden, I think that changes a little bit. So it'll be very interesting to see like Oklahoma State and all that T-Boone money. Like, is Oklahoma State going to be like one of the top five programs in America now because they have oil money to throw around? Like, but all these schools are all wet rich, like Texas A&M, Texas. I mean, how do you decipher? I mean, Vanderbilt has a boatload of money. It's just a matter of how it's going to be employed. And I don't think we really know how it's going to be until it actually happens.
The other element of all of this, and this is sort of in line with your self-fulfilling prophecy, is there's an electricity to the major programs. If you go to a game in Tuscaloosa, if you go to a game in State College, if you go to a game in Columbus, if you go to a game in Baton Rouge, if you go to a game in Gainesville, whatever, these major schools, there are tens of thousands of people tailgating 11 hours before kickoff. That's not the case in Pasadena. That's not the case in a lot of Pac-12 schools, a lot of Big Ten schools. Like, there's a certain amount of electricity where your UCLA question is basically like, it's electricity. That's what Pete Carroll was able to generate. Now, that's lightning in a bottle. Pete Carroll is a star NFL coach who happened to coach in college for a while, and he has a charming personality, and there were celebrities there. UCLA has to, or any school like this, you mentioned ASU, but Texas Tech, there has to be the next random Khalil Tate accident there. There has to be something that draws attention and draws b- butts into the stands, because any random UCLA game at the Rose Bowl is not going to draw that. And so I would also look, search college football to see who are the assistants that are underappreciated in terms of churning out NFL talent. Who is like the next, was it Craig Kuligowski was at Mizzou and then Alabama, Miami, like then just kept developing NFL defensive linemen. Who is that guy? That is a way to think where it's like, okay, how am I going to turn these 3 and 4 stars into top 3 round picks? And what does that beget? UCLA is a tough, it's an academic school. It's in a pro sports town. Like, you're just not going to be able to change certain elements of college towns. You're not going to be able to make Minneapolis any warmer and closer to what the weather of Tuscaloosa or Austin. So I think a lot of it is luck. I think a lot of it is strategy. And when you do strike lightning in a bottle, whatever that is, you have to immediately build on it. You have to immediately say you can be the next. Like, UCLA needs to find Michael Vick, right? Like, Blacksburg wasn't a hot spot, but what Michael Vick was able to do was turn Virginia Tech into a major program. And it was good coaching and good program building that everything in Blacksburg came together after they made a national championship game to sustain that success. Short of that, I mean, Virginia Tech was never a sexy elite blue chip school, but they built on that success. And anything short of that, I don't know what you can do. You can't change geography. You can't change the culture in your region. You can't change much.
I think that, who do you think is the most exciting college football player of the last 10 years to watch?
Last 10 years?
Yeah.
So post Cam Newton. So some Heisman winning quarterback, I guess. Johnny Manziel.
Yeah.
Kyler, Baker. I'm trying to think.
I think that it's a very clear answer, in my opinion. And if you don't think exactly what
there
I
are a
think,
lot of
then
names.
You're wrong.
Yeah.
But I think
yeah.
it's Lamar Jackson.
Oh, sure. Yeah. That's a great answer.
And Louisville is what it is. And it's just like, the thing that's so interesting to me is that the haves and have-nots of the sport are so intimately related to the geography. It's like Oregon State is one of the worst programs in college football because they are located in the middle of nowhere and can't recruit the way they need to recruit to get there. Now, there are certain transcendent schools that, like Oregon, conquered the Nike uniforms, cool offense thing, and they did what they needed
to do. That's electricity. Yeah.
Electricity. It's a really great way to put it. But it's funny, when you look at the six schools that got all those players, none of them are really in a place like L.A. or a place. The only one is Georgia, which is close to Atlanta for high school talent, but Tuscaloosa, I mean, Alabama's got their players, but it's nothing like Texas or Florida. You look at Clemson, South Carolina. I mean, is that Clemson or is that Dabo? It's probably Dabo. Oh, Columbus, Ohio is a nice city. I lived there for 10 years, but it's not a hotbed of elite level talent. There are great players that come in and out of Ohio every year. But a lot of the blue blood programs that are in this position right now aren't like sitting on top of 5 or 7 top 100 players every single year. And a lot of these schools have unique recruiting advantages, like Ohio State and LSU are the only Power 5 schools in a very talent-rich state. And those kids that grow up in those states want to play at those schools. So, you know, there are certain recruiting advantages for these programs. But the hardest thing to do is to go from, like I said, the 15th best team or the top 20 team into a top 5 situation. I think you can go from 50 to 15 easier than you can go from 7 to 4. And I don't know what the answer is. Do you just hope you find the light? I would just argue that you could find the lightning in the bottle coach. Like, as Dabo, I think Dabo is a genius. Like there's nobody who's been able to take a solid program and turn it into one of the perennial powerhouses the way that he has. Right. And there's certain levels of genius. Like Pat Fitzgerald, I think, is a coaching genius for what he's been able to do at Northwestern. But like, even those lightning in a bottle type players like Michael Vick and Lamar Jackson and some of the guys who won the Heisman, these schools, after they have the excitement and the really good years that result of having these talents, kind of dip back into what they were before as time goes on. So how do you make UCLA like in the marketing department? When I covered Ohio State for 10 years. So at the end of the seventh year, and before I left the Cleveland Plain Dealer to go to the Athletic, I wrote a story about the expansion of their recruiting department. And I'm sure you guys are aware of this, but they've got a 10-person recruiting staff that they're paying over $1 million a year to have. That's marketing, that's talent evaluation, that's film breakdown, that's communication, that's visits. That is insane. And like, some schools have different budgets for recruiting. So I think you have to up the recruiting budget. at some of these places. But if you're not near talent, then you're not near talent. And if you don't have the tradition, you can't build the tradition. So how do you make a Clemson into a Clemson? Like, only one person has been able to do that in the entire sport. How many hotshot young coaches have there been over the years? Tom Herman was one. Now he doesn't have a job. Like, it's over and over and over again. You see these guys come and fail. And it's just like, what is in the sauce? Because Dabo and Nick Saban is an alien of his own regard. But Urban Meyer, before he left, there's only like five or six of these guys that can actually do it. And the thing that I think too, forgive me if I'm rambling, but being a college football coach is two jobs. It's being a good coach, roster development, and putting players in a position to do the best that they can from a coaching standpoint. And then there's recruiting. And the problem is that you don't have a lot of coaches who are very elite at both. And that's another challenge. But I just don't know exactly where to begin. And sometimes I feel bad because the sport would be more fun if you went into a year where it's like there's 27 teams that could win a national title this year. But the answer to that question is actually five.
You can host the best backyard barbecue when you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Ryan Day takes over for Urban Meyer. The early part of his tenure as a head coach has been incredible. He's had Justin Fields. But now Ohio State moves on beyond Fields as he goes pro. One of the things that Dan and I have talked about from time to time in the past is taking over for a legend. Very difficult spot to be in. Ryan Day thus far has done really well. It doesn't seem as if there are any signs of that slowing down. But is Ryan Day, does he belong in that same elite class of coaches, or is it too soon to say at this point?
Everything I learned about recruiting and all the things that I spew off from you on this show and on our shows, I learned from Urban Meyer. I mean, I sat in that guy's press conferences and was around him every day for 7 years. And to me, despite his faults, I think he's the most brilliant program builder that there is. And I think even towards the last 3 or 4 years of his tenure at Ohio State, you can make the argument that he wasn't as good of an on-the-field game coach or a developmental coach, because I think Ohio State, at the same time, you could say is the most underachieving program in college football for what they have on their roster. So when you say, what do you do with Ryan Day? At a certain point, it has to become Ryan Day's program. And so far, he's lost 2 games. He's been to the playoff twice. He beat Clemson once. He went to the national championship game. But I think he would, you know, when you say it's really hard to take over for a coach that's a legend, sometimes it's super advantageous because Urban Meyer handed the man the playbook that he built. And it's like, would Ryan Day's results be what they are right now if he took over for Tressel? No. And like, that's the truth. He took over for a guy that made Ohio State cool, and then he's been really great at maintaining its coolness. And if you talk to Ryan face-to-face, he's a great guy. I could see why kids would want to play for him, but he's already driving the Ferrari that somebody else built. So would I put him in that category? Absolutely. I think he's an elite coach and he's done a really good job of putting his teams in a position to win a national championship. And their recruiting, believe it or not, has actually been better during his tenure than they were when Urban left. But I think that part of the brilliance of being a college coach is the build. And I think that's what Urban Meyer liked doing the most, which is why he had short tenures at the places that he did. Well, part of the reason. And if you don't build it, then I think there is a certain element that's missing for me, which is the same reason why, as much as I love Lincoln Riley and watching his offense is beautiful, he didn't build it. Maybe he built it a little bit more than what it was, but Dabo built that. I mean, he built that with his hands, you know, and to me, when you start talking about the most elite coaches in college football, I start with who built something and maintained it. And then the second tier is who's done a really good job of driving somebody else's car. Now, if Ohio State is still really, really good in 8 years, and I don't see that they wouldn't be with the way that they're recruiting right now, then that's a different discussion. But I don't know. I think you need more than 2 years before you start really trying to put Ryan Day in that same breath as Dabo, a coach that he just beat. But I think it just takes time.
Are there any promising young mechanics or contractors, anything like that to you in terms of how construction has begun in earnest, and, you know, 2, 3, 4 years, whatever, into their tenure?
Yeah. And I think that's how I would begin with a coaching hire. You know, I would look and I would put it in those terms. And I hate to be cliche. I really do. Yeah. But I think Matt Campbell is the answer to that question. And okay. I don't know if people are like, well, crap, why is he like the golden child of the sport? It's like, guys, I think that the 247 composite talent rankings are basically my Bible. And I look at them and I compare them.
Yeah.
Iowa State was like in the 60s last year. And they almost won the Big 12. And like, to me, when you build a program, Iowa State is a solid program. They haven't won their conference and they can't beat. Well, they can be, but they haven't beaten Oklahoma or Texas when it comes to winning the conference. They've beaten both of those teams on the field, but they haven't won the conference yet. But at a certain point, the hardest thing with being a college coach, I think, is identifying a plan, executing that plan, and then proving that that plan works. And I think that Iowa State has done that. And I don't know that it can be duplicated. And no other coaching staff in America has evaluated talent at the high school level better than Iowa State has. And they take these under the radar players and they turn them into really good football players. They found Brock Purdy. You know, they've got these guys on this roster that can make them competitive with Oklahoma. And like, that's not supposed to happen. And, you know, and Pat Fitzgerald has done that too, but Pat Fitzgerald is basically born on Northwestern's football field. So,
right.
You know, to me, I would go get a guy who took a place that doesn't have advantageous geography, has proven that he can evaluate talent at an elite level and then develop that talent into a team that has a lot of chemistry. And that's how you build a program. And then when you go and take it to where Iowa State is now, you recruit incrementally better. And as you recruit incrementally better, you still have that evaluation skill and then you build something. But the problem with architects or mechanics, however we put it, is that once they get to a place like at Iowa State where they do what they're doing, they usually get plucked by Michigan or Oklahoma or one of these teams. And then those teams have outrageous expectations and don't have the patience to let them build the car and then fire them before the car is done. And then the next mechanic comes in and builds a different car. So like, I think that's part of the problem at like Tennessee, for instance. You might find the perfect coach, but they don't give them time because they think they should be Alabama in year three. And that's not the way it works. And like Dabo, how many years did Dabo have? Did he have 7 before he started winning like at a high level? And it's like in the modern day of college football, they just don't get the opportunity to do that. And it's about incremental change, incremental improvement over time. And it's not something that can happen in 3 years. And until college football programs have the patience to endure what can sometimes be painful for 5, 6, 7 years to watch that process play out, you keep changing the cook in the kitchen and then it keeps starting over from day one. And that's why you see these lulls that last 10, 15, 20 years.
This has been a very logical approach to building a program, Dan, right? If you want any kind of continuity, have some patience. Leave the guy in there who is doing a good enough job for the time being and see what he can do. If you want to get better players, up your recruiting budget. I mean, a lot of it's straightforward, right? But it's
hard. And then don't spend all that buyout money instead of buying out a coach that's not very good for $30 million and paying him not to coach, use that investment to bolster your recruiting staff and bolster your facilities and do things for your program in order to put itself in a position to do that. And over time, if you see improvements, you might take a step back or you might lose more games than you want to, but you can see which teams are building something. And I don't know if Iowa State will ever be a team that can win the Big 12 or win a national championship, but if you take him, Iowa State could have been one of the worst jobs in the Big 12, and it's not because of what Matt Campbell's done. And if you've shown and illustrated that you have an ability to build a program, that's the number one bullet point on anybody's resume. It's not even about wins and losses. It's how much can you achieve with what you have as a resource and then extrapolating it based on what more resources you'll get at your next stop and giving that person time to revel in it, you know?
It's Pat Fitzgerald to a T.
It's all it is. If you go look at all the schools that are the have-nots that have out-punched their weight class, a lot of the, I think probably 8 out of 10 times you'll find a coach that, you know, has been there for a long time, has a solid plan, and has continued to follow through on that plan. I mean, if people think that you can, like Nick Saban is a robot genius sent from college football heaven to rule the sport. There aren't a lot of those guys out there. So you need to be patient. And if the goal, because too, it's like every Power Five conference, maybe outside of the Pac-12 right now, has an unbeatable giant at the end of the road. So it's like, if you're in the Big Ten and you want to win the Big Ten, you got to beat Ohio State. If you're in the ACC, you got to beat Clemson. And it's like, look at Mac Brown, for instance. This guy has kept North Carolina kids home immediately. And it's like, I know he's getting up there in age, but North Carolina still has a Clemson ceiling. So, like, no matter what he does, he's still going to have to beat Clemson. And in the SEC, you've got Georgia and Alabama. You've got LSU. I mean, there's three or four of them. So a lot of the times we're using these architects or these mechanics for building programs, but they keep running into the giant. And I don't think it's rational to expect them to beat the giant. I think it's rational to expect that they illustrated they're able to build something so that when they become a coach at one of those giants, they can continue that success.
It's also the factor of, you've mentioned basically all these things. What was the Kill Bill, like 5-point pressure assassin, whatever thing at the end of, like, you need everything to click, right? You need the right coach. You need the right support. You need the right money. You need the right geography, and you need luck. You need your starting left tackle not to break his tibia.
Right.
You need to build depth. You need buy-in from boosters. You need the patient. Like, the thing that I'll never be able to sort of overstate to me is every year Nick Saban's replacing his entire staff. Every year Nick Saban has Alabama boosters in a line. When he says jump, they say how high, because he is in charge rather than vice versa, which we see at all sorts of powers across the sport. And so to make these, you talk about Dabo, but that doesn't come from a traditional power. He built that in the modern way. But you go to a place like Texas, it just seems impossible. It just seems impossible to get that five. What is it called? It's called the pressure point. That's what it is. The 5-point pressure point thing. Like it the degree and the barrier to entry into the playoff right now requires so many things firing at once that I almost feel like we should be reframing the appeal of the sport. I've been pushing that on the show for a long time, that the appeal of the sport isn't the top of the sport. It's the totality and it's the experience and it's the entertainment of the sport. But that's hard to say because people watch the sport to see their team win games. So it's easy for me to say because I host a national show, but unless the mainstream sort of broad fans become interested in Iowa, Wisconsin, become interested in Florida, Tennessee, become interested in Texas A&M, LSU, even if there's no national championship on the line, I think it's going to be easier and easier for people to just kind of check out and opt out of college football.
Yeah.
And unless we can reframe it in some sort of, like, you know, the NFL has fantasy and gambling and the NBA has free agency and the draft. Like, there's all these appeals to other sports that college football is just never going to have. If you want to get into recruiting, you have to be on message boards. Like, if you want that experience, you have to be deeply, deeply into it and listen to the Solid Verbal and listen to Ari Wasserman's podcast and read his column. Like, there's a barrier to entry that's legitimately pretty high to me as a fan.
Right. And then when you also think about how much, like, I know it's like hard to think, but good teams lose to bad ones all the time. You're constantly walking a tightrope. So even when you build it the right way, I mean, you're one call or one play away sometimes from the entire season being blown, because the beauty of college football is that you can lose and it can ruin everything.
Generally to Kansas State.
Yeah, exactly.
That's how it works.
Or Purdue. You know, and it happens all the time. And I don't really know, because it's such a physical sport. I don't, sometimes when you see some of these upsets of 30 point underdogs, I still don't know how it's even physically possible, but it happens all the time. And it is.
And the wild card is getting 19 year olds to care cohesively.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I also think recruiting and trends is the popularity of all that, I think, is increasing, you know, and I don't know. And there certainly is gambling in college football, too. And recruiting is a huge resource in how to view these games. But I don't know. It takes a lot of energy to follow a class, because unlike NFL free agency, which is the span of a few weeks, the entire talent accumulation phase of college football is 24/7, 365. And now you're adding the transfer portal into it, and you're adding, you know, potential eligibility waivers and lawsuits for immediate eligibility. There's all sorts of crazy stuff on like how do you get a player in college football can happen in like 10 different ways. JUCO transfers, right out of high school, grad transfers, instant. I mean, it's insane.
And Australia.
Australia. Exactly. See, this is why I like you. You're funny.
Yeah.
And like watching, by the time you get to 85, it is a whirlwind of 365 days of craziness to get to that 85. And then even when you get to that 85, players leave and transfer, and it's just insane. But the thing that I love about college football is that despite the fact that there are only a few teams that can win a national championship, the passion across the board for people and their teams is relentless. It's unwavering. It's wonderful. And if you go look at one of the teams that we think is one of the worst 15 jobs in the Power Five, that message board is popping. There's one at every place. And the problem is I just don't know. I just sometimes wonder too. And I went to Arizona, and I don't care about Arizona football at all. And I covered it when I was working at the student newspaper. But sometimes I thought to myself, what's the point of being an Arizona football fan? Like, what is the point? Is the point to win the Las Vegas Bowl? Like, is that what we're spending all this time and money, energy, thought process, message board payments, all the things that you need to be a passionate Arizona football fan? For what reason? To win seven games? It's like, that to me is awful. Like, why would I want to do that? But at the same time, pride in the school and pride in the ability to potentially improve what you are and hope for improvement over time is what keeps people going. And the only way to improve over time isn't whether or not you win games on the field. It's whether or not you can win recruiting battles. And to me, the most intriguing and most interesting things that happen in the sport don't happen. I mean, obviously, Saturdays are amazing, and that's the reason I wake up in the morning. But there are battles happening between Washington, USC, and Michigan right now, and you can follow them. And those are the things that are determining whether or not your team has a chance. And to me, I think that's kind of fun, because during the NFL offseason, you have free agency, you've got the NFL draft, but people are insane about the NFL draft. Why? Because the players on the team impact whether or not your team has a chance to win the Super Bowl. It's the same thing with thing with recruiting, except it's going on constantly. It's like, I would say crypto recruiting is the cryptocurrency of the stock market. It doesn't stop.
GameStop is okay. to answer your question, because I've been to a game, why be an Arizona football fan? If you're a college kid at Arizona, you can go to a gathering with a ton of attractive humans and drink alcohol and then meet other attractive humans. And occasionally you'll beat a ranked UCLA and rush the field, or a ranked Oregon and rush the field. And even though it's known as a basketball school, there's also not a ton to do in Tucson. Like, football games are fun. Like, we lost that, and we talked about that this past year. Like, I think Iowa State, Oklahoma had like a healthy amount of crowd in Jack Trice Stadium. And it felt very strange, even though it was the first season we haven't had that. Like, a game in the desert, even if Arizona's 7-5, 8-4, you could have lost the last game by 20 points and still like, wow, look, Willie Tuatama's hitting. We've got Gronk. Like, there's always that hope element, which is the selling point of college football and college football recruiting and next year and Phil Steele's magazine, whatever. But as long as we talk about the sport not exclusively through the lens of the playoff, I think there's always going to be appeal.
Yeah. And I don't know if, like, the expansion of the playoff is the answer to that question, or if it's going to make it worse. Because if you expand the playoff and then you still never get in, that makes it worse.
Yeah.
But like I was talking about, just being a fan that wants to listen to this podcast and really consume the sport so that you can view it through an Arizona lens. Listen, I've been to Arizona football games in the Zona Zoo section, some of the best nights of my life. But if you look on the other side of the stadium, there's a bunch of older people who don't go to school there, who invest their money and their time and their thoughts and their message boards and Go AZ Cats and all the things that used to be popular into like what is fueling your love and hunger to consume things when Arizona's class might have been the first Power Five class in the history of recruiting rankings to not sign at least one Power Five class that didn't sign one top 1,000 player. And it's like, when that doesn't happen, then like, what are we doing? You know, right. So, you know, I guess the thing is, well, fire your coach and try again. And then you hope the next coach is the right guy. And the one thing that's for certain about college football is there is a never ending supply of hope, you know, and that's what's fun. But at a certain time, too, it's like when you're an Arizona fan, and I was there during the Willie Tuitama lived in my hall my freshman year. And it's very like, nice. I remember a lot of things about that. But when they were kicking people's butts and he was throwing the ball over the field, like people were excited. It was fun. But even in a year like that, they still, especially if that year were to happen this year, 0% chance of winning a national championship. And it's like, right. I think that takes a little bit away. And it's like, as fun as it was to watch BYU last year in Coastal Carolina and Cincinnati, 0% chance of winning a national championship. And until that changes, there's going to be a problem. And I don't know, maybe it's just the beauty of the sport, but that's where we're at right now with it.
Yeah. And I, you know, I wonder about the playoff expansion as well, because I think I've been a fan of that since they announced that there was going to be a 4-team playoff. Why don't we go to 8? Why don't we go to 16? And like, there's definitely something to be gained if you are, we'll use Iowa State as an example, to say that, hey, we went to the playoff, come and play here. Maybe you can play at a playoff or in a playoff game too. I get that. I can't see any scenario in which the same like 3 or 4 teams aren't still the ones left in the end.
Right.
So it's a recruiting point.
And fewer people watching the semis and championship game after Alabama just destroys Michigan by 31 points in the quarterfinal.
Right. Yeah. So it's
like, what's the point?
There's definitely something to be said for it as a selling point with recruiting. But at the end of the day, it's like, what matters? Is it winning that championship? Is it establishing yourself as a playoff team that you can take out on the road and then sell to some of these recruits who maybe you couldn't get in the door with before? I don't know the answer to that, but I'm definitely like, I'm still in favor of expanding the playoff. I just don't think it gets anywhere close to solving the parity problem other than making some teams feel good, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I look at college football as a very unique sport. Now, maybe the NFL is like this too, but if you're an NBA fan, are you watching Utah Jazz play Sacramento on a Tuesday? Probably not. I mean, they're not a lot of casual fans. If you're a right. Major League Baseball fan, are you watching the Pirates and Reds 3-game series because it's baseball? No, you're not. Now, NFL, everybody's involved in gambling and fantasy. Everybody likes watching all the NFL games. But in college football, we all want to watch all of them. And I think that's really a unique thing. And what does the college football playoff expansion do? Well, I think we all know what would have happened if Alabama played Coastal Carolina last year, but we all sure as hell would want to watch that, you know? And I think the idea or the hope of getting to see these matchups and then maybe certain things happening like it does in the NCAA tournament changes the dynamic of the sport. I mean, getting on the same field, like Coastal Carolina couldn't have done anything in the world to get on the same field as Alabama last year.
Right.
And that sucks. And Cincinnati, probably even more so than the smaller schools. I mean, they're in the 6th Power 5 conference. I mean, the AAC is really good. And they've got really good football teams. I think you could make the argument that Cincinnati was the 3rd or 2nd best team in the Big Ten last year. And the fact that they weren't able to be included in potentially competing against those other teams sucks. It frankly sucks. Now, we all probably know what would have happened, but I'd rather see it. I would rather see it.
I mean, we did see Ohio State Cincinnati 2 years ago,
but we also saw Alabama Ohio State and the second most talented team in college football got their doors blown off. So, like, I mean, if blowouts are the problem, then you need to find a different sport because they happen when the best teams are playing each other too. So, like, I don't know if the final score of Alabama Coastal Carolina would have been 66-10, and I guess you get to a certain point where that just sucks. But the idea of the hope of seeing something special, I think, would change that. But I don't know if that would be the answer to how these teams can recruit better. Like, recruiting better is the hardest thing to do in all of sports. I don't even know what the answer to these questions are. And people are like, well, what can my favorite team do to be better? Like, I have mailbag questions every week. And you have an Oregon State person say, what can Oregon State do to be a team that competes in the Pac-12? And even though they've done that in the recent past, the answer is, I don't know. And that, frankly, sucks. Yeah. Like every other team in every other sport, you have a clear, if you're a Buffalo Bills fan in 2007, what do you need to do? You need to analyze and draft the best quarterback with your draft positioning. You get these free agents at these positions of weakness, and you might be able to compete. In college football, sometimes the answer is you are what you are, and I think that sucks.
Also, TJ Houshmandzadeh.
Yes.
That is the other answer. No, I think essentially what we're all dancing around the same thing is like you just have to learn to love something that's imperfect. I think that's the key. My wife learned to do it. Ty's wife learned to do it. And I'm not going to call you imperfect, but you now have a fiance. Segue.
That was better than we planned.
It was better than we planned. You recently got engaged.
I did.
You are in your early 30s, yes?
Yes.
Early 30s?
Yeah, 33. Okay. I don't know if that's early. Early to mid.
You've already passed my dad's mandate that he handed down to me when I was like 10 years old to not get married before you're 30, which I think we all are going to accomplish. And you live in what? You live in the Dallas-Fort Worth metro area?
I live in Dallas, yep.
You live in Dallas.
Just recently.
How is the engagement? How long have you been together? Did it all go smoothly? What went into everything? The people want to know.
Yeah, okay. Well, I lived the best 20s that anybody can live. And I know that that sounds like I'm not trying to be a frat bro, but like I traveled, I partied, I met girls, I gambled on sports, I went to Vegas, like all the things that everybody wants to do in their 20s, I did. But as that was happening and as I got into my upper 20s, all of my friends started following the natural progression of girlfriend, engagement, move in together, buy a home, baby, wedding, all that stuff in that order. Not that order, but wedding, then baby at the end, right? So for me, I met my fiance, her name is Brittany, 3 years ago, and I met her through a mutual friend. But we had long distance relationship because we really liked I don't know how I convinced her to like me, but we really liked each other. And because I'm a college football writer and she is in the commercial real estate industry, she's traveling a ton, I'm traveling a ton, we made it work and we saw each other a ton. And I'm a psychopath who will drive anywhere at any point, no matter how far away it is. But then I moved.
I like Ari Wasserman. Yeah. I just like Ari Wasserman.
Yeah. I one time drove from Columbus, Ohio to Fort Lauderdale, Florida for one night.
Like, was it for a woman?
It was for Britt. Yeah, she was down in Fort Lauderdale.
Oh, it was for her. Okay, just making sure. Yeah. Good answer.
Yeah, that was a really far drive.
I didn't know if you just were playing Hialeah. I don't know.
No, I've driven 3 hours for lunch and 7 for casinos. Like, we all have done, but like I will do that, and I made that work. But so I moved to Texas for her. You know, I used my situation at The Athletic, and I said, hey, I want to be a national writer. I want to do these things. I think it'll work. Texas is a wonderful place for a football writer to live because of all the talent and it's centrally located. They allowed me to move. So then I moved in July, right in the heart of the pandemic, with a person I'd only been seeing long distance in their house. So that was like an adjustment because I'm a dude and I've never lived with a girl. So like doing the dishes and unloading the dishwasher and taking out the trash and doing all the things proactively that I wouldn't do at home, was a challenge. But then now we have an engagement. We're trying to buy a house. We're probably going to be trying to have a baby soon. All the things that are happening for people in a progression have all happened to me within one calendar year where I'm not allowed to go in public.
Wow.
So it's been great. I'm excited, but it's also been like, holy crap, I can't believe what my life was 13 months ago and what it is now. So I'm really excited, and I surprised her. I invited all of her friends from all over the country to come and go into a private room at a restaurant. I proposed to her haphazardly, like in the kitchen. She's like, are you really doing this right now? Because she had her hand in like baking powder. And I just said, mm-hmm. I had to do it because I've never been able to keep a secret for her for more than 5 minutes. And I kept this whole thing for a month. And wow. if I said, let's go to dinner here or let's go on a walk here, she would have immediately known. And then we walked into this room and my parents and her mom and all of her friends and everybody was in this room and she had no idea. So it was great. It's been a real, real crazy weekend. My parents just left and I guess I'm an adult now.
Congratulations.
Hold on. She said yes. Did you, Nicole Auerbach told me you traveled to another state for the ring. Is that true?
Yes, I did.
Did you know her style? Did you know her size? Because that was something I knew beforehand. I think, Ty, you knew.
I did.
Yeah, yeah. No, I knew all those things.
That seems important.
She threw, it wasn't direct, but through months of accumulated ideas, I think I got the idea. But I didn't go to Florida to buy the ring because it was a special ring. I bought that thing 2 miles away from my house. I found that there was a tax situation where if you send the ring to Florida and pick it up in Florida, then you don't have to pay state tax or state sales tax in Florida or Texas. So my best friend's father lives in Boca Raton. I sent it to him. I told Britt I was going on a business trip and I went to the Hollywood Casino for a night and enjoyed myself out in Florida, took the tarp off by the beach, picked up this ring and brought it home. 9% is a lot of money when you're buying an engagement ring. So like, and with Corona, the flights were $103 round trip. I have Marriott points. It was a very inexpensive, and I won a few thousand bucks at the casino, which offset. So I saved money on taxes and then I won money at the casino.
And you paid
and
for
I
the
got
ring.
A night alone and I paid and I, and that, and that's how I got the ring.
What do you play? What's your game?
I like poker because it's the one game that I feel like I have control over.
Huh. Okay.
I can't, fair enough. I love blackjack and craps and all the games that everybody likes playing, but poker, I can use some sort of ability and or maybe limited ability, but I feel like I know how to play really well. And I grew up during the party poker era and now everybody's good, but I really enjoy that game because I have the patience to sit there and fold until I feel like I have a hand I want to play and I know my spots. And for the most part, I think I do pretty good at it. If you play blackjack, you can't control if the five cards. Right. I mean, it just you play by the book and you lose. I mean, it's not as fun to me, at least when I'm alone.
You were down a ton of weight, by the way, when we did the show. How's that going? How's that journey?
I'm still not there.
Okay,
I think
fine.
I've lost probably 25 or 20 more since January.
Wow. Grand total?
Grand total is like 103 or something. So
it's unbelievable.
Ton.
Amazing. That's so great.
But like, here's the thing too, I wanted to say, like, I don't think I'm like, I think I'm marginally attractive and every single person.
Ty was just saying. Yeah.
I know. And every single person on Twitter, because I made the mistake of tweeting our picture and there's some pretty vulgar responses and really mean spirited responses, but everybody said, bro, you outkicked your coverage.
Right.
And I thought to myself, like, that's nice. Like, are we complimenting Britt or are we insulting me in that? Like, how many of those do you get before you are offensive? It's like, because I didn't know how to feel about it. I was like,
can I tell you
amazing.
My reaction when I saw the picture?
Yeah.
You posted the picture and my reaction was, and I think it's now your profile picture. My reaction to the two of you were like, first, what a great looking couple. And two, someday, and Ty, if you want to bring up the picture and take a look, I don't know if you have it in front of you. Someday they're going to have almost like a Bob Diaco level kid hair wise.
Oh,
two incredible heads of hair.
Yeah, she has an incredible head of hair. Everybody who says best hair couple ever. And that's the one thing God gave me, you know?
It's
everybody,
unreal.
Everybody gets something and I got a good head of hair. But, you know, it was a wonderful weekend. And aside from some of the terrible things people say on Twitter, which I've learned to no longer pay attention to, I've got no complaints in the world. So now we've got to plan a wedding and we are currently in a position of potentially putting an offer in on a house like as we speak. There's a lot of stuff happening all at once right now. But I got to say, I'm truly blessed. And, you know, one of the things that made this week such a blessing is I got to come on the show. You know, let's not forget that.
You will give birth, Ari, to a hair hero.
You're seeing the picture right now.
I'm seeing it now. I hadn't seen it before. Yeah. Congratulations.
Yeah.
You will give straight out of the womb, that child will have a luscious, flowing head of hair.
Yeah. And her mother's a hairdresser and like does a really good job of volumizing, I think is the word that the women like to use. And I get the volumizing and I use volumizing hair, despite having the thickest hair on earth, just because I don't ever want my one trait that I don't have to like genetically battle to go away. So, you know, I'm going to the gym every day. Proposal picture was great for what it was, but still not happy with the final result. But when we finally get to the wedding, I hope that by then people are going to be like, oh my God, you totally kicked off your coverage perfectly.
This is a wedding podcast masquerading as a college football show.
That's what we're
so
at
as
right
we
now.
As the date gets closer, we will have you back on to just itemize and just have, you know, do we need that few number of high top tables? Maybe more.
The guest
maybe
list.
People love
we
a good high top table.
Shivari chairs. We do an ice sculpt. Yeah,
oh my
the
God,
whole thing.
Ty.
So can we like cater my wedding with your pizza?
I would love to. I could do late night. I don't have a pizza oven. I just have a standard oven, but there are options in Dallas for me to do a pop-up. Maybe. We'll see.
I mean, I don't know, and I'm sure you're probably trying to wrap this thing up, and I have a hard time.
No, it's fine. If you have any pizza questions, I'm here too. And if you have any questions about, I mean, if one of the next steps is having kids, Ty has a webinar.
Oh, yeah.
on that process.
Send me a link.
It's so detailed.
Number one, how to do it, and then we'll
probably
go from there.
More vulgar than you're expecting from Ty.
Yeah.
Like, he could have toned it down in certain spots. Chapter 4 is a doozy.
Yeah, well, I need some help. Guys, I'm about as far away. Listen, man, I talk about college football for a living.
Yeah.
It's like, how juvenile can that be just out of the gate? And then I was living in Ohio in a bachelor pad and, you know, just kind of doing my own thing. And now we've got a blind dog who I've heard you probably heard barking intermittently throughout the podcast.
Oh, that's cool.
And, you know, potentially having a child here in the near future and all the things that come along with adulthood. And, you know, I couldn't be happier. But the one thing, there's no buddy that has been a bigger fan than me about this pizza. Like, I tweeted you.
Yeah.
I feel like I got to stop because I'm like, this guy's getting sick of you.
No, by all means. It's very rewarding and complimentary.
I have a very specific pizza taste. There are a few places that I think really hit. I think for the most part.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Phoenix, Arizona.
Oh, you grew up in Phoenix, which is a pretty good pizza town.
It is a great pizza town. It's a great food town because everybody is from somewhere else and they bring their food with them.
Yes.
And it's the only place where you can get a great New York slice, a great Chicago slice. And, you know, I know that like St. Louis and Detroit have their own styles now. And I saw you did a Detroit one.
Yeah, don't worry about St. Louis. They use garbage.
I thought Emo's was incredible, though.
Really?
I like it.
Okay, I haven't been to Emo's.
Yeah.
So I've had Prevail cheese and I was not a fan.
Yeah,
but maybe Emo's is great.
But I know that that's very... controversial. But the thing that I know, much like a lot of businesses, the pizza industry is dominated by mediocrity. It really is.
That is true.
And there are so many pizza places and a lot of them are just fine. And bad pizza is still pizza. So we eat it and we eat it because it's carb filled. But there really isn't, for as much pizza as I've eaten in order to get to the fattest I've ever been. It's quite staggering. And I can't tell you, I'd probably say maybe 5% of the time I sat down and said, wow, this is really delicious.
And do you have, which pizzerias stand out to you?
So
you've traveled.
If we're talking about Phoenix, there's a place in Spinato's, or called Spinato's in Phoenix, that I think is unbelievable. And it's high quality toppings. They've got great sausage, great pepperoni, and they have sweet sauce. And I don't know why, but I've always been partial to sweet sauce.
Good.
But I also have come to find out, too, that the eye test is probably more telling for pizza than any other food category. And when I look at yours, it looks like perfect. It's like visually
it's really
perfect. And I know for a fact that it's delicious because the elements that what make pizza delicious are all in place in your pie. And I don't know what needs to happen, but if that was the pizza that you were spitting out all day, every day to customers, I think you would have a very successful business because I think people are willing to pay for good pizza. Everybody buys crap pizza,
so too.
But I think people are willing to pay for good pizza.
So the problem with pizza, though, the problem pizza has is people associate it with like, oh, drunk, order a pizza. Oh, it's Friday night. I don't want to cook. Let's just grab pizza from the local place. It's a very casual food that can be done really well. But there's just a certain social element of like, okay, pizza is this stand-in for cooking yourself or for, you know, you're having a game. Just get a bunch of pizzas. It's a volume thing for a lot of people. I think a lot of pizza places cut corners in terms of their ingredients and their process, whatever. It's same day dough instead of letting it ferment for a day or two. It's, you know, the cheaper cheese that burns too easily, or it's the cheapest pepperonis that don't cup or whatever. So I get it. If you're selling a bunch of pizzas, why change anything? But I think especially now that I live in the burbs and there's pretty decent pizza where I am, but you know, I was in New York. I was in Brooklyn for 8 years. I ate a lot of mediocre pizza in the supposed pizza capital of America. So I your point is well taken. I think I need to cook for you is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Because I'm on at least three pizza message boards in which people are sharing tips about like protein percentage and flour and hydration.
It's insane. Like when you're tweeting about these things, it's so far over my head. But you know what? And I don't mean to interrupt you, but there is something that used to happen in Las Vegas that I don't know if it happens anymore, especially now.
Have you been to Tony G's? That's the big guy there, right? In Vegas?
I don't know that I've ever eaten there.
Tony G's, yeah.
But Vegas has a pizza convention. And I heard that it's like $50 to get in, and all the major vendors and pizza places all over the country come set up, and you can eat everybody's pizza. And like, I want to go there with you.
I've been invited by a couple different people to go to the Pizza Expo. They do one in Atlantic City and they do one in Vegas. I know a couple of people that are in the pizza industry, and they've both invited me that I could get a pass. So as soon as I can, and as soon as my wife allows me to leave our two young children to go to a pizza convention in the desert, we'll meet there and we'll eat.
I'll drive them. From Dallas.
I would love to drive there too. There's a certain fantasy you have about sitting in a car alone once you have a 2-year-old and a newborn.
Well, like, you have to listen to awesome college football podcasts like this.
Yeah. But, yeah.
I mean, I think I would leave journalism, I think, if I had a business plan that I think you could, like, I mean, and I'm not even joking. Like, as a kid,
I
thought that having a real pizza place, a place that spits out really good pie over and over again. And even if it's $20 a pizza, which is a lot of money to some people, like Spinato's, if you're ever in Phoenix, you got to try this place. And it's cut and squares.
I've been to Bianco. I actually use the Bianco di Napoli tomatoes in my pies.
So what's your take on Bianco?
I haven't been to Pizzeria Bianco in quite some time, in probably 8 years since I last went to, it was either a national championship or a Super Bowl there, but I thought it was delicious. I thought it was fantastic. That's a style that I really, really like. I know he's also making New York style pies occasionally, like 18-inch big pies there. I thought it was phenomenal.
It was like
I also shot a video
pizza,
with him.
Right? With like lettuce or, I mean, arugula on there and stuff.
I think he has Neapolitan, like some of the more like esoteric type pies, but you can get a fantastic just like soppressata pie or like shaved garlic and sausage. If you like, he does a lot of really straightforward excellence.
Yeah.
So he's one of my favorite pies. I have places in New York I love. I have places in the Chicagoland area I love. LA, I have places like you can get excellent pizza wherever. It's just more difficult to search them out some places.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah. And it just when you know it's good, you know, like immediately.
Yeah.
When this is top notch stuff here, we're talking about, you know, and I know people get kind of passionate about the triangles and the shape and the density and the thickness.
Yeah, whatever.
And I like thin, maybe not cracker, but like thin square cut pizza. That's high quality with nice sausage, nice pepperoni and sweet sauce. And it's just like a hard thing to find. It really is.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure there are really good places in Dallas.
Unfortunately, right now I'm on a short leash.
Oh, well, okay. So you're losing poundage, but at some point when you have some sort of cheat meal, I'm sure there are options.
Yeah.
This is my recommendation for everything. This is the way Ty is specifically with podcasting, and everybody should be with something. Like, you should be deeply nerdy about something that has nothing to do with your work. Like, that has nothing to do with your day job. And for me, it's pizza just because, you know, you're literally getting your hands dirty and you're experimenting and it's delicious even when you kind of screw up. And so people pay me for my pies now. Friends and family like refuse to accept them because they're at a high enough level. I don't think they're doing it just because they like me. And so I don't know what the next step is, but I am making things sort of behind the scenes now because
I'm
happy.
Say, before you let me go, last question.
Yeah.
And Ty, I love you, buddy. I'm sorry. I just got sucked. I got sucked.
No, Ty has pizza thoughts.
Okay. I don't mean to like box you out.
Yeah,
here.
No, you're good.
Please, we invited you on. Please.
Yeah. Is the plan one day to open a spot? Like, would that be a dream?
Is this a
hobby? Is this a goal? Like, where are we at with this?
We are using this for our pizza startup podcast to be named and to be slotted.
So
Solid Verbal Pizza. I would eat that.
It's an option. I mean, I still like my Valley Circle pizza name. It's easy to spell. It's easy to remember. The problem is I know how difficult and taxing working and starting a restaurant. I mean, pizza's okay just because it's year round and the ingredients aren't terribly expensive. You know, flour is not expensive. Tomatoes and cheese aren't terribly expensive. I know prices fluctuate, but maybe. I think, do you know who Joe Badia is?
I do.
Does that name? Okay. So his place in Philly, where his older place, he made 40 pies a night and that was it because he wanted full control over everything. And people seemed to really like it, and he did his thing, and he got recognition. He made some cash. That to me is interesting, but I'm really trying to take this incrementally. I don't want to just rent a shop next week. Like, I really need to get my formula down. I really want to sort of make initially sort of content out of it, because I get a ton of messages like, "What's your dough recipe? Can you give me your step by step process?" And like,
and don't
it's very difficult to do on
that's
Twitter.
It.
No,
okay, yeah, I'm
mean,
saying like,
not for free,
screw
not for
off.
Free.
Yeah, like I mean, yeah, no, yeah. This is something that I mean, you don't give away your see. I mean, it,
right?
I wonder honestly if you think about every pizza restaurant that's ever been built or opened, how many people spend time like figuring out the levels of how much. Whatever protein or whatever it is.
Well, like even if you knew Spinato's recipe, are you making it at home? Are you buying a pizza oven? Are you mixing the flour? Are you experimenting with fermentation times?
Exactly.
Are you tracking down the Spinato's cheese and tomato vendors?
But do people that like, own restaurants worry about those things? Like, do they come
no.
up with a perfect recipe for the perfect pie and go, this is my gift to the world? Or is it just, well, we'll throw some pizzas together and hope that people buy them because
no, I just don't think people care about giving out the recipe just because it's such a labor intensive specific thing that they know that, yeah, sure, maybe a competitor. But like, if you are the originator and you have the reputation for your pies, I don't think it's a huge deal to give out. Maybe you charge. Maybe you write a cookbook. Maybe you do a video thing. That
I just
you
don't think
for.
That
maybe
people
something
who
like
own
that.
A lot of these restaurants put as much effort into perfecting the recipe
no.
the way that you have, which means that
no.
your pizza would be high quality and worth paying top dollar for.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, I have this specific vision. I tweeted it out a while ago. We're just like, I just want a couple of arcade machines and the red Coke cups. Like, I don't want to.
Yeah.
Like, I think places get bogged down when they're like, oh, we do wings, we do chicken parm sandwiches, we do salads. Like, no, let's
my father
make
told
awesome
me at a
pizzas.
Very young age, if pizza restaurant serves other things that aren't pizza, it's trash. And
yeah.
maybe not wings, because wings kind of go with it. But if you can get a Philly cheesesteak at the place that serves pizza, never order the pizza at that place.
Yeah. The best pizza in Brooklyn is this place to me. It's called Lucali. They make pizza and they make calzones, which is just folded pizza.
Yeah. And I don't know what it is, but as I get older, I'm starting to gravitate more to just cheese pizza. I love
sure.
my pepperoni. I love my sausage. Everybody does. But as I grow older, I feel like I just want cheese, which is weird.
The key is, and this is the ultimate move, like you go to a place with three or four people and you get three or four pies. And
oh,
what
yeah.
we do in normal times when we go with, you know, when Jody and I go with another couple is you have a draft. You have a draft at the table. That way everybody is insured to get what they want. Like, it's not like, should we get a cheese, a pepperoni, and a veggie? Like, no, let's go around the table and you select which one you want to be represented at your table. That's key. So you
I
make
think
sure
I'm
you get
you.
Your cheese pie. It's, feeling is mutual.
Oh man.
So
I really enjoyed this, and it's a personal, I'm just flattered. A personal goal has been achieved. And I also hope that talking more intently and more passionately about your pizza
yeah.
recipe than my engagement isn't a representation of who I am as a person.
I'm excited for, are you getting married this year or next year?
Probably next year.
Okay.
And we have a lot going on between them, but that's a promise. I'm going to take you up on it.
The Wasserman Wedding 2K22 podcast.
Yeah,
maybe it's a whole like limited run series, Ty.
It could be.
Maybe it's our version of Startup.
We know people. We can make that work.
I love it. I love
it's
it.
Awesome.
All okay. right. Ari
That's
Wasserman. Again, he's from The Athletic. Go and read him today. Follow him on Twitter. Where else are you, Ari? Just Twitter?
Just Twitter. Yeah. And The Athletic. If you want to go right to it, just come to The Athletic. I don't need Twitter followers.
Yeah.
Go find Ari. Read
Done.
His stuff. We will have you on again soon, Mr. Wasserman. Thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so much for having me, guys. I really appreciate it. It was great.
All right, Dan. Ari Wasserman, The Athletic.
Yes.
Check him out. Big fan of your pizza, huh?
I guess. I hope it tastes as good to people who have eaten it than it looks to some people, I guess, because people seem to like looking at it. But I could honestly, like, I don't know. I don't have a pizza friend.
What is
so,
a pizza friend?
I don't know. I'm still trying to figure out what that is, but I don't have somebody in my life personally that I could bounce like 60 versus 65% hydration advantages, disadvantages with, or topping supply. Like, I don't have that person. Ari loves pizza, clearly, but he's not that person.
Right.
So
we're talking about the George Costanza mentor-protege relationship, but for pizza.
Correct. Yeah, I don't even know if I need a protege or if I need a mentor. I just like, you know, when, like, at your day job where you're like kidnapping terrorists and all that kind of stuff that you do, like, you have people to bounce ideas off of. But, like, I'm sort of a rock. I'm a man on an island.
Mm.
And I rely on message boards and rely on people and people's experiences. There's a lady who used to cook in, there was like a market in Amish country. Do you know what I'm talking about? I sent her a link. Her name is Norma. And she's an older woman. She won this like incredible pizza contest a few years ago, like in the New York division, like the New York style division. And she posts, like, she's definitely like an older lady, and she posts these incredible looking pies. And I've never communicated with her, but I was like, man, it'd be pretty nice to hang with Norma and just talk shop. But she's an actual successful pizzaiolo. Whereas, let me find where this market is.
Is that the word? Pizza?
Yeah, that's the, like, the Italian.
Okay.
Norma Pizza in Mannheim, PA.
Okay,
I don't think it's open anymore. It was at the Roots Country Market.
Okay. I know Mannheim.
But this lady Norma apparently made the best pies in just a random part of PA.
That's central PA. That's bordering on extreme central PA right there.
But she's on this pizza message board. One of the it's pizzamaking.com where I go, and people are like, well, here's my copycat recipe of this very specific place in New York. And I could see that he was milling his own flour, but I'm not sure if it was hard spring wheat or it's really intense.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Well, great conversation with Ari. I have nothing to contribute on the pizza front. I enjoy
pizza. No, it's okay. I still say you have to find you. I told you, I was like, Ty, you got to find your thing. You got to find like something to obsess over, either building or cooking or something. And your initial response to me was grilled cheese. Do you still feel that way?
No, it was just an idea. No.
Okay. I think you got to find, maybe
I might just stick with the omelets.
Yeah, but you've made maybe new kinds of omelets. Maybe
I tried the French omelet, a little too runny. Little too runny.
Okay.
We'll figure it out.
You need to find your whale.
All right. Well, solidverbal@gmail.com. Write in. Let us know your thoughts. Check us out, verballers.com. That's a Patreon. Don't forget to follow along on social media and through your podcasting app of choice, Dan. Why don't we let the fine people go?
Go. Stop listening to my pizza nonsense.
For that guy over there, my good friend Dan Rubenstein, for myself, Ty Hildebrand, thank you so much for hanging with us. We'll talk to you again on Thursday. In the meantime, stay solid.
Peace.